evil face. The K is for the kill, L is for the lover, and the M is for the mutiny, and I wish it didn't happen.
Pirate radio, arr, gar, gar. Pirate radio, where's my drum?
Now the N is for knots, or no, my bones are sinking. The B is for the peg leg that keeps me standing up. A Q is for quantum leap, R is for the rum, and the S is for the scurvy, which I wish it didn't get.
Pirate radio, arr, gar, gar.
That's underneath my boat. And B is for Bukitas, who plays a sour note. W is tie is this, X marks a spot. Why? Cause I'm a pirate.
Pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, where's my grog?
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 88.1 FM from the heart of occupied Washington. We are news from the front line. We can be reached at WSQTRadio@hushmail.com, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Thursday, July 22nd, 2010. Netanyahu reveals his true feelings about the U.S. and Oslo Accords, and occupation forces sentence a Berlin protest organizer. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. In a video recorded in 2001, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is shown talking candidly with settlers who lost family members in Palestinian attacks about military strategy, foreign policy, and its relationship with the U.S. Netanyahu explained Israeli strategy during the Second Intifada as, "The main thing, first of all, is to hit them. Not just one blow, but blows that are so painful that the price will be too heavy to be borne." Netanyahu went on to talk about how he did not act in good faith during the Oslo Accords. He said that the use of the term military zones in the West Bank was a term subject to interpretation. He was not the prime minister at the time, but discussed Israel's most important ally in this way. "I know what America is. America is a thing that you can move very easily. Move it in the right direction. They won't get in the way." A leader in the protest movement was sentenced by an Israeli court to 2 months in jail while facing another trial in the coming months on Wednesday. Abdullah Abu Rahma was first detained in 2005, then put on trial, and was finally sentenced on Wednesday. He will serve 2 months with a suspended 6-month sentence. He also faces another case against him with a wide variety of charges leveled against him, charges including activity against the public order, obstructing a soldier in the line of duty, and incitement. Many have pointed out that these charges effectively show him simply exercising his right to free speech and being punished by the occupation forces. In response to Abu Rahma's sentencing, the spokesman for the Berlin Popular Committee, Mohammed Khatib, said that Israel is trying to intimidate us, to dissuade from fighting for our rights, but what other options do we have? Both the wall and the settlements on our lands are built in contradiction of international law and even of Israeli law, but it is us that end up in jail. In Tiberias, a 23-year-old Arab man was beaten unconscious by an Israeli Jew after the suspected assailant saw the victim talking to a young Jewish girl whom he was previously acquainted with. Israeli police say they know the attacker and are actively looking for him. Out of Washington, a State Department spokesman has stated that any final status issues can only be discussed in direct talks between Arabs and Israelis. Final status issues include what the borders will look like of a two-state solution and Palestinian security autonomy. These same issues Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas would like to have agreement on before any real direct talks start. Anything less would be futile, in his words. There are also reports that the Israeli military and their bulldozers destroyed 10 animal stables and some fruit stands in Jenin District Wednesday. Thank you for joining us from Occupied Bethlehem. You've been listening to Palestine Today from the International Middle East Media Center. For a constant update, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. This report has been brought to you by Brian Ennis.
Tuesday, insurgents beheaded six policemen after attacking their checkpoint in northern Afghanistan, according to NATO. The occupation forces said the militants attacked a number of government buildings Tuesday in Baghlan province, Dagana-e-Gori district. The attackers overran a checkpoint and decapitated the six policemen. Afghanistan, Tuesday, two U.S. civilian trainers were killed when an Afghan soldier suddenly opened fire on his trainers. Presumably these were mercenaries. Another Afghan soldier was killed in the crossfire. Afghanistan, Wednesday. A Danish soldier was killed by an explosion in the south, according to NATO. This brought total NATO deaths in Afghanistan for July to 65. Afghanistan, yesterday. Two British occupation soldiers were killed by small arms fire in the Lashkargah district, Helmand province, according to the British military. Kabul, Afghanistan, Tuesday. An intense rocket barrage prevented a plane carrying United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon and Swedish Foreign Minister Carl Bildt from landing at Kabul Airport on Tuesday, and the aircraft was diverted to Bagram Air Base. It had to be ferried from Bagram to the occupiers' international conference by Black Hawk helicopter. Kandahar Airfield, Afghanistan, Tuesday. Rockets hit the NATO occupation base, striking an Australian installation inside. Pakistan, today. At least 100 NATO oil tankers were stopped by Pakistani security forces Thursday in Khyber Tribal Agency in northwest Pakistan, local media reported, citing official sources. They were stopped for safety reasons, as a backlog customs clearance on the Afghan side of the border at Torkham has created a massive backup of waiting trucks. Diyala Province, Iraq, yesterday. A car bomb outside a mosque killed 15 people and wounded at least 30. Wasit Province, Iraq, Tuesday night. Four Katusha rockets hit the U.S. military's Delta base west of Kit City, a local security source told Oswat Al-Iraq news agency the next day. Diyala Province, Iraq, yesterday. A U.S. soldier was killed by a roadside bomb. Probably this was the IED attack on a U.S. patrol outside Magdalia, reported elsewhere. Mr. Barack Obama, the U.S. is supposed to start removing half the occupation troops from Iraq in weeks, but U.S. troops are still being blown up by roadside bombs. I think it's quite clear who has won in Iraq and who is going to win in Afghanistan. Now is the time to cut your losses, bring all the troops home today from both of these wars with no exceptions.
And no amount of money you could give me, honey, couldn't pay me, ain't going back again.
Those army recruiting ads had to have side effect warnings like drug advertisements on TV do.
The United States Army may not be right for every patient. Side effects can include distress, disillusionment, bitter resentment, isolation, traumatic and post-traumatic stress, sociopathic behavior, uncontrollable sobbing, uncontrollable violence, prosecutions for war crimes, prosecutions for domestic crimes, loss of contact with loved ones, loss of ability to love, brain injuries, blindness, depleted uranium poisoning, flashbacks, horror of death, horror of being away from death, loss of the use of limbs, loss of limbs, death, suicide, excruciating pain, the desire to feel excruciating pain, overwhelming rage and misery, loss of hearing, punishment by the Army for failure to obey illegal orders, punishment by courts of law or by enemy forces for obeying illegal orders, torture, humiliation, shame, dangerous habits of blind subservience, or the wasting of what could have been the best years of your life. If you experience any of these symptoms, deal with it, sucker. You already signed your name on the dotted line.
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 88.1 FM from the heart of occupied Washington. We are news from the front line. We can be reached at WSQT Radio@hushmail.com. WSQT Radio@hushmail.com.
Bolivia is the poorest nation in South America, but has a proud history of militant protest by its citizens, demanding the nationalization of the country's energy resources to benefit the impoverished indigenous majority. That same progressive force elected Evo Morales of the Movement Towards Socialism Party, Bolivia's president, in 2005, and he quickly took control of the nation's oil and gas industries. Now, with the world searching for alternatives to polluting fossil fuels, whose CO2 emissions are one of the principal causes of global climate change, Bolivia's vast deposits of the mineral lithium are attracting international attention. Lithium, a likely key component for the manufacture of advanced batteries necessary to power a new generation of carbon-neutral electric cars, could prove to be a significant future source of wealth for poor Bolivians. A recent report of similar large deposits of lithium and other valuable minerals in Afghanistan released by the Pentagon was viewed by many as a bit of propaganda to rally fading support for the war. A report titled "Bolivia and Its Lithium: Can the Gold of the 21st Century Lift a Nation Out of Poverty?" published by the Democracy Center in May, examines the economic potential, environmental costs, and foreign capital necessary to launch a large-scale lithium mining project in Bolivia. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Jim Schultz, executive director of the Democracy Center in Cochabamba, Bolivia, who assesses the rewards and dangers of lithium mining and production for the people of Bolivia.
You know, Bolivia is shares the characteristics of being the most indigenous country in all of the Americas and the poorest country in South America. And the irony of that, of course, is that Bolivia has sat on one chair of gold after another. There's a hill here in Bolivia called Cerro Rico, Rich Hill, which is not a very big mountain. And for over 200 years, that hill virtually bankrolled the Spanish Empire with silver. And so, you know, Bolivia is ground zero for the theft model of resource development. And the same thing happened later with tin and the tin barons. It happened with the privatization of the country's gas and oil under pressure from the World Bank and IMF in the 80s and 90s, the heyday of the Washington Consensus. And so here we are in 2010, and Bolivia is sitting on the largest single source on the planet of lithium. Listeners who were Star Trek fans remember lithium crystals powering Starship Enterprise. Well, it turns out that automakers are looking to lithium to power electric vehicles so that, you know, that plug-in Toyota Prius that people in the northeast of the United States might be dreaming of off into the near future may require lithium that comes from Bolivia. So on the surface, it's a really interesting opportunity, because here's Bolivia that once again it finds itself sitting on a chair of gold in terms of natural resources, but now at a time in which it has a president, Evo Morales, who's signaled very clearly that the old ways of doing things are not the new ways of doing things, that the theft model of resource development is not an option, that Bolivia intends to make sure that it makes the money off its lithium by controlling it, and by getting its hands in industrialization of the product, because, you know, it's economics 101 that if you're sitting on a natural resource, the way you make the money is not selling it off as raw product, it's by making stuff with it. You know, Evo has said that he wants to make, if not cars, certainly batteries. So that's the surface. But when you dig deeper, which is what we did in our report, which is available for free for anybody who wants it on the Democracy Center website, the story, of course, is much more complicated.
In the report, you talk about the resource curse, where you have the paradox of the potential wealth, but also the potential drawbacks of corruption and environmental devastation that we've seen in the development of other resources around the world. I guess we can only look at the Gulf of Mexico today to see some example of that. But certainly, as you said before, there's a colonial heritage in Bolivia that has really not helped the people of Bolivia at all when it came to mining other resources, natural gas in the past, until some recent changes by Evo Morales as president.
Well, you know, the resource curse is an idea that's been around for a long time, and it's a pretty simple analysis, which is if you look at what happens when you have an impoverished country, Bolivia, Chad, any of these countries, and you look at what happens when it finds a treasure of mineral wealth under the ground, the fact is that it ends up almost always being worse off than if it had found, you know, plastic under the ground. Why? First of all, because of corruption, it tends to not actually benefit the people. I mean, you think about how exposed a country that pays very little to its civil servant, the exposure to corporate corruption is enormous. Secondly, whenever you take a country where people are desperate for any kind of economic opportunity and suddenly you hold out the opportunity that there might be some real wealth, the conflicts that erupt are just extraordinary. And we've had that here in this country over gas and oil. In Chad, in Cameroon, you have literally a civil war over oil. So it's very difficult. What the Bolivian government is trying to do here is very difficult in terms of trying to break the resource curse. They may succeed, they may not, but that's really what's at stake here. I would also say one other thing, because you mentioned the Gulf, and we've said that in our presentations here in Bolivia, that one thing we can learn from what's going on in the Gulf is that wealth and access to the highest levels of technology are absolutely not a guarantee of safety from an environmental disaster. I think that we've learned that once again in the Gulf of Mexico. And you take a country like Bolivia, where the money is much less and the access to technology is much less, I think that even raises the stakes higher in terms of the potential environmental consequences.
That was Jim Schultz, Executive Director of the Democracy Center in Cochabamba, Bolivia. Visit the center's website at democracyctr.org to read a copy of their lithium report.
The wealth gap between blacks and whites in the United States has ballooned over the past 25 years. A study of the Institute of Assets and Social Policy at Brandeis University found a typical white middle-class family owns five times the financial assets and wealth as the typical black middle-class family. The study, which tracked 2,000 families since 1984, found a quarter of black families had no financial assets at all. The study did not measure the rise and fall of housing values owned by black and white families, which is harder to track than other assets like stocks and bonds. Currently, the top 1% of the U.S. population owns 40% of the country's wealth, and the top quarter of families own over 85% of all financial assets. In contrast, a third of the African Americans do not have a pension to pay for retirement. The Brandeis study also found that African Americans and Latinos were more likely to be sold risky and higher interest rate mortgages during the recent housing boom.
ACORN, the Association of Community Organizations for Reform Now, had long been a target of the Republican Party and conservative activists for their successful voter registration drives, effective organizing on fair housing issues, and living wage campaigns. The 40-year-old group, with 400,000 members and offices in 75 cities, was frequently under attack by right-wing commentators and politicians whose unfounded charges were often reported unchallenged in the corporate media. Persistent allegations that ACORN had committed voter fraud, which helped elect Barack Obama president in 2008, were found to be baseless. But when conservative activists James O'Keefe and Hannah Giles, posing as a pimp and prostitute, released edited covert videotapes last fall, purportedly showing ACORN staff offering the phony couple assistance to establish a brothel for underage girls, right-wing groups immediately demanded an investigation and the defunding of the group. Congress quickly complied, passing resolutions that cut off federal funds and sealing the fate of the group, which announced its demise in March. In his new book, Seeds of Change, The Story of ACORN, America's Most Controversial Anti-Poverty Community Organizing Group, John Atlas, public interest lawyer and organizer, examines the group's successes and flaws, providing an honest assessment of its contributions to organizing America's working poor families. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Atlas, who discusses important chapters in ACORN's history covered in his book, and the failure of progressive activists to come to its aid when it mattered most.
The story of ACORN begins with Wade Rafty, who grew up in the South in the 50s and 60s, and it was a period of time when there was widespread resistance to school integration. And he then dropped out of Williams College, and he drops out in order to pursue his dream of organizing poor people so that they could build a powerful organization and help lift themselves out of poverty. Now, he comes out of the welfare rights movement, which is a single-issue group focused on just welfare recipients fighting for welfare rights. One constituency, very poor, fighting one issue. He realizes that that's not going anywhere for the poor that he wants to help. And so he decides to build a multi-issue, cross-class organization that represents a majority of American people, because he thinks that is the only way you can make a significant difference on behalf of the poor, as well as the other millions of people who are less powerful than our large corporations.
In its 40 years, ACORN worked on any number of fronts. They did neighborhood organizing. They worked a lot in housing and giving people who couldn't afford housing access to buy their own homes, living wage campaigns, voter registration drives that they were enormously successful at. Outline some of the most significant successes that ACORN had during its time.
A couple of good examples. ACORN is probably more responsible for an increase in the minimum wage, which basically meant millions and millions of people were getting wage increases, and forced in 2007, forced President Bush, against his will, to sign an increase in the minimum wage. That's an enormous exercise in power. And they also passed dozens of living wage ordinances. Those are also tough to get. You're up against powerful corporate interests who have a vested interest in keeping wages at poverty levels. A third example is an amazing battle that they had with the Household Finance Corporation, a predatory loan operation that was making, $15 billion in loans in 1999, 2000. But they were doing this by ripping off people with these predatory subprime loans. And ACORN organized a national campaign mobilizing 50 state attorneys general to join ACORN in a lawsuit, which resulted in $600 million returned to the people who were ripped off by Household Finance. They could not do this unless they were a national organization. One of the things that it's so hard to do in a short interview is to give you the drama behind how hard each one of these battles is. But that's some examples.
When it came to the final act in Acorn's 40-year life, conservative activist James O'Keefe and his friend Hannah Giles, they did this editing of videotape, which in the end turned out to be not an honest representation of what happened when these two posed as a prostitute and her pimp trying to get help from Acorn. But more importantly, how could this whole scandal have played out differently so that Acorn could have survived?
The reality is, at this time in our history, there is a powerful conservative media that framed the debate as, did Acorn engage in helping a prostitute get a brothel? Did Acorn engage in voter fraud? That was the only question that the media was asking, instead of the questions that they should have asked, which was, were any of these things factually true? And the mainstream media is severely guilty of failing to do actual reporting, going into communities and trying to determine what actually happened. So the only way that this could have turned out differently was if there was a powerful progressive movement that said, you know, we're not going to let one of our own, one of maybe the most significant progressive organization in the last four decades, to go down. We're going to defend it. We're going to find out what happened, and then we're going to put pressure on politicians and the media and save Acorn.
Now, with the dissolution of Acorn this past March, what is likely to rise out of the ashes of Acorn that can stand up and do some of the same work that this group did over the past four decades?
Well, the good news is that the 16 states and the New England region, there are many of the old Acorn organizers, there are allies, there are people who like the Acorn model, and they are resurrecting the old Acorn model community organizations with its focus on going door-to-door, organizing dues-paying members, working on many issues. And I think they're going to rebuild, and I think they might even be better than the old Acorn because they're going to be learning from some of the mistakes, which I go into in the book as well. So hopefully something better will emerge.
That was John Atlas, public interest lawyer, organizer, and author of Seeds of Change, the story of Acorn, America's most controversial anti-poverty community organizing group.
Well, DNA is natural. It's the building block of life. And when the good Lord put it together, you know, I think he did it upright. He made lots of different organisms, a complex web of life. Each one depended on another, and so the circle had closed up tight. But then along came a man and a microscope, and he separated the genes. And when he put them all back together, he made lots of strange, unnatural things. And now food crops grow on the ocean floor, cows that grow on trees. Now the ranchers gaze while their oysters graze on grass that depends on a hormone spray in our genetically modified world.
500 animals a day die every day in a so-called laboratory in New Jersey called Huntington Life Sciences. Researchers at Huntington Life Sciences have been caught punching beagle puppies in the face, cutting open live, unanesthetized monkeys, and oh yeah, a scientist who quit his job with Huntington Life Sciences was sued for reporting that he had been ordered to falsify test results. Since Huntington Life Sciences produces no consumer products, only test things like bleach and Splenda, there is therefore a campaign of boycotts, protests, and direct action against any companies that invest in Huntington Life Sciences, that deliver supplies to Huntington Life Sciences like Staples does in unmarked trucks, or customers of Huntington Life Sciences like GlaxoSmithKline, one of whose vaccine tests in Argentina killed 12 children.
On the 18th of July, animal rights protesters showed up at the home of Keith Carr, a senior corporate official with Legg Mason, which holds one-sixth of all shares in Fortress. It is loans and loan extensions from Fortress that have kept puppy-killing Huntington Life Sciences afloat. After people finished at Keith Carr's house, they marched in the home of John Richardson in Georgetown.
John Richardson is the head honcho of Abbott Fund,
a charity wholly owned and operated by Huntington Life Sciences customer Abbott Laboratories, whose greedy pricing of brand-name patented drugs is the only reason for Abbott Fund's existence in the first place.
For your victims, we will fight!
We know where you sleep at night!
For the animals, we will fight!
We know where you sleep at night!
Oh, Lord,
yeah! Here at 2500 Massachusetts Street, Keith Carr, who's in Fortress, and holds up a company called Huntington Life Sciences, continues to kill puppies, 500 animals every single day!
Puppy killer!
You heard that, Keith Carr. There's just something about your company, Leg Mason, holding 1/6 of the shares in Fortress that bailed out puppy-killing Huntington Life Sciences as bad karma, especially when it brings 30-plus people out to your ritzy home on Massachusetts Avenue disturbing all your neighbors. And John Richardson, down in Georgetown on P Street, that goes double for you. Some of your neighbors were very unhappy to see animal rights protesters again in front of their homes.
He just said he knows where I sleep at night.
You came out of your house, it's obvious to the world.
John Richardson, your neighbors especially don't like it when the cops can't stop animal rights protesters from coming to your neighborhood. Just remember, the cops couldn't stop the October Rebellion in 2007, the IMF and World Bank protesters who marched on Georgetown, and they can't keep Huntington Life Sciences protesters out of your neighborhood either. Only you can do that by dumping Huntington Life Sciences. And until you do, in D.C., there's no sleep for the wicked.
On the 19th of July, dozens of protesters swarmed on Huntington Life Sciences customers in downtown D.C. The protest featured the storming of Bristol-Myers Squibb.
They got it. In.
Security guards horribly countercharged, sticking cameras in activist faces and screaming for cops to make arrests, but the police never responded.
Bristol-Myers Squibb inside this building, you've seen your lobby stormed and invaded constantly, week after week and month after month. Today, Bristol-Myers Squibb, again, we the peaceful activists come out in mass. We were asking you, Bristol-Myers Squibb,
go ahead, make my day. Earlier that day, protesters showed up at 701 Pennsylvania Avenue, home of Bayer and Novartis and AstraZeneca, and 801 Pennsylvania Avenue, home of Sanofi of Venice. Heard that? For the cat and for the mouse, we are coming to your house, which is exactly what protesters had done the previous day with protesters at the homes of Huntington Life Sciences customer executives.
Huntington Life Sciences, in case you've forgotten, Sanofia,
is a contract animal testing facility. They kill 500 animals each and every day of the week, and they've been exposed in 7 separate undercover investigations, punching beagle puppies in the face, dissecting live primates, and mutilating rabbits to the highest bidder.
During the protests at offices on July 19th, both Bayer and Sanofi of Venice were called out for their past as part of Germany's notorious IG Farben, maker of Zyklon B.
This is a bunch of pharmaceutical companies in Nazi Germany to form IG Farben. IG Farben was directly responsible for Auschwitz. They were directly responsible for the deaths of millions of Jews and queers.
Didn't they own 25% of Auschwitz?
They built the entire thing. Then, after World War II, and after the Nuremberg trials, his premier, who worked for Bayer, was thrown into jail. After serving 7 years, he was brought back on as the head of Bayer. After that time, there was a fine set up in his name that still exists today. In his name, in a Nazi murderer's name. Currently, this headquarters has gone on to kill over 50 people and many others around the world. It's dangerous, it's deadly. They've released their Liberty Link rights, which is GMO rice crop, into the regular rice crop, potentially contaminating all the rice we're eating with GMO garbage. Bayer is one of the worst companies in this world. They went from killing humans to now killing animals and humans. They are scum. They're the worst scum in the world.
That they most assuredly will be. The campaign against Huntington Life Sciences never quits and never loses. One way or another, Bayer, Novartis, AstraZeneca, Sanofi of Venice, and Bristol Myers Squibb are going to dump Huntington Life Sciences. Is your SUV running low on gas? Is your wallet been running on fumes lately? Well, this is Behind Pollution, offering blowout prices on regular, plus, and premium at every BP Behind Pollution gas station, where you can get a gusher of savings filling up that Ford Excursion or that Hummer. And never mind our blown-out oil well at Macondo in the Gulf of Mexico. Never mind all those oiled pelicans. And never mind this burning hot summer of global warming. Never mind the voices that tell you to boycott BP for the horrific things Behind Pollution has done in the Gulf of Mexico. Just keep filling up that SUV. Just keep enjoying that gusher of savings the blowout prices at BP gas stations are bringing you. After all, you never liked seafood much anyway.